Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Big Ticket Variety and iHeart's Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today, I've got Hugh Grant. But before we get started, I have to tell you that I interviewed Hugh on the phone. He was in London. I was in Los Angeles. So there might be a little bumps in the audio, but I promise it's not that bad. Besides, you'll want to listen through because Hugh has lots to say. He talks about his new Emmy nomination for A Very English Scandal, why he's thought about running for political office, and what happened when he was offered a role in a superhero movie. Stick around, we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Now, Hugh Grant. Hello, sir.
Mark.
How are you?
Just excellent. You, how's your day going?
My day's going good. I'm glad we're finally connecting.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's been chaos.
No worries, no worries. Congratulations on the Emmy nomination.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Was it expected at all?
No, I'm the man who spent 35 years never being nominated for anything. there's been a flurry in the last few years. But it's all been very unexpected and very nice. Very nice.
When
they seldom come, they wished for come.
So are you someone who would prepare an acceptance speech, or are you going to just do it on the fly when you win?
Obviously, I shan't win.
You have a good chance. It's not like everyone's nominated.
Well, is that right? You would know more than me. I'm hopeless at this stuff.
So why is A Very English Scandal very English?
Well, to me, one of the most English things about it is that it's just so amateurish. You know, This is a man trying to kill another man, or trying to take a hit out on another man. If he was an American, he'd get it done properly. But being an upper class Englishman, it's just hopeless. You know, a friend says, I think I know someone, who says, I think I know someone. And, you know, they end up with an out-of-work aeroplane pilot who's a drunk and who goes to the wrong village and is frightened of dogs. And it's just, if you accept that failure is very English, amateurish failure, then I think, you know, nothing is more English than the Thorpe scandal.
But you also have, you know, James Bond. You know, the English have some
He's fantasy.
There's nothing like James Bond really going on.
Well, I don't know. You make a good point. I suppose we do have some trained killers. But on the whole, failure is the name of the game. And you know, I love the fact that all this takes place in the rain, you know, all that sort of attempted murder in a terrible downpour with a large dog in the back of the car. And it's a really crap car as well, a 1970s hopeless Triumph Dolomite or something. With a smell of wet dog in the air. And the victim slightly fancying the killer. It's marvelously English.
You know what? As you're describing it, I'm like, this can't be real. This has to be made up.
I know. I agree. But it really was, and I remember it.
What do you think about Jeremy Thorpe? Do you find him sad?
Yeah, very sad.
Yeah,
very sad. I mean, and that's the key, really. If you can find their tragedy, then you can sort of quite like them. Mm. And it adds a bit of warmth under the reptilian exterior. I think he was that. I think it was very, very difficult to be a gay man in the years when he was coming of age. And that's one thing. I also happen to think it's very difficult to be a narcissist on the scale that he was a narcissist, because it kind of prevents any real human connection.
Right.
And I think that's rather lonely.
Mm. Right. He was sad. He was a narcissist. And even till the day he died, it sounded like he would not acknowledge this affair.
Correct. He would not. In the brilliant adaptation by Russell T. Davis, he did do that. He created that moment just before the verdict comes in the courtroom, when I'm sitting in the corridor with my barrister.
Mm.
And I come as close as I've ever come to confessing
right.
that it's true when I talk about all the dangerous liaisons that a gay man in those days was compelled to have, you know,
right.
furtive little meetings and laboratories and so on. But basically, he never came out.
Did you find anything that you liked about Jeremy?
I would say, people have asked me that before, I'd say it's not exactly that I liked him. It's that I enjoyed him.
Mm.
Which means that I enjoyed his pathology, his weird English misery and pretensions, and the vast distances between his exterior and his interior, the strange contortions that people throw themselves into,
right,
to try and get through life. These are the things one enjoy. I enjoy as an actor, and I enjoy as a viewer. I enjoy as a human. It's a bit different from liking. Was he a kind man? Well, sometimes I think he really loved his boy. I mean, I think
right.
he loved both wives, even though to a certain extent they were just beards.
Mm.
But so he was capable of love, but he was also an absolutely pure, distilled narcissist in a way that only politicians can be, really.
And we have a lot of those narcissists.
It was all about him. Well, that's what, you know, that's what I realized researching Thorpe, and certainly what I realized over the last 7 years becoming involved in the British political scene for the first time in my life, was that the cliche about politics being show business for the ugly is absolutely true. It's all the same people, the same instincts. It's just they don't look as good. It's all the same me.
Right.
And Boris Johnson is the absolute epitome. The archetype.
Why do you think the world is embracing these men like Boris and Donald Trump?
I think there's a natural backlash to the very smooth Teflon politics that were kind of invented by Clinton and then came over the Atlantic. Everything done by focus group, by polling, never making a mistake. Never falling into a bear trap, being endlessly politically correct to the point of, you know, pain, really.
Right.
I think there was always bound to be some backlash against that. And I think it's been that's been very cleverly magnified and exploited by some quite dark forces.
And in this 7 years, how many people have come to you and say, run for office?
None.
Would you ever?
I do. I think I get so angry reading the news, especially now, so incandescently angry.
Mm.
I sometimes think that would be a good thing to do.
So what would be your campaign slogan?
Well, my main slogan would be, I don't want to be reelected. Seems to me that the desire to be reelected or a career politician poisons everything.
Wow, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, because it seems to me that the first, when politicians these days make decisions about, you know, any kind of political strategy, the first priority is, how will this go for my personal career? Second is, how will this go for my party?
Mm.
The third is, how will this go for my backers who've, you know, paid for me, especially in America. I think applies
right.
more than here. And, you know, somewhere way down the list is what's actually good for the country. And I think if you started a party that said, we really don't give a damn if we're elected or not again, we're just ordinary people who are coming into this to do our public duty, try and save the country from a bunch of nuts, it might be quite popular.
So why don't you do it?
Well, I have thought about it a bit, to be honest.
Really?
But I think I'm too easy a target. My cupboards are full of skeletons. My past is full of, you know, there was so much muckraking could go on, and I can take it. I've been taking that for a long time.
Right.
But I'm not sure I want my family to have to suffer that.
Because we do know that there are a lot of politicians who make it no matter how many skeletons they have in their cupboards.
I agree, especially nowadays. But yeah. As I said, it's not really about me. It's about my family. They wouldn't like it.
Right.
They're not politicians. They're, you know, three-year-olds. And or my wife, who's not that kind of person. So I don't think I can do it, really.
Right now, we're going to take a quick break, but when we return, Hugh recalls the time his parents saw him on the cover of a gay porn magazine. Plus, he reveals that he was recently offered, but he had to decline a role in a superhero movie. Now we're back with more of Hugh Grant. Let's go back to the show because, of course, watching the show, I couldn't help but think of Maurice, another closeted man.
Yes, that's exactly right. Did you spot what I think is an echo, deliberate or possibly subliminal, at the end of the series? When I'm on the balcony celebrating the verdict with my, you know, my wife, or my mother whispers in my ear, of course, you know you're ruined, don't you? And I look all sad. Mm. And then we cut to Ben in on a bus. And it's like a flashback to when we were happy and in love,
right,
on a bus back in the 1960s. And I suddenly realized that was incredibly similar to the last scenes of, or the last moments of Maurice.
Wow.
Of Maurice, when I'm looking out of the window, I'm shutting the shutters, big metaphor. Mm. My wife is getting ready for bed. I'm taking off my tie, shutting the shutters. And as I shut them, I look out of the window. I look down out of the window. The garden, and it's a flashback to me looking down out of the window at Cambridge, and there is Maurice staring up at me, you know, with eyes full of love. Yeah, and I think there's a huge echo there, and I don't know if Russell intended that or if it was just something that, you know, came through him.
That's pretty amazing. If he didn't think about that and it just came through him, that's pretty incredible.
Well, maybe it certainly came through me because I remember suggesting to him, it was always written at the end of the series that I would stare silently into the distance and then we'd see Norman Scott on a bus all alone. And I said, I think this could work better if we, earlier in the series, we have a scene where we're very romantic on a bus.
Mm.
And then we did write that scene in, or Russell wrote that scene in. So it must have been some... So I think he must have been aware of that,
right,
what we were trying to do.
So when you signed on for Morris, did you anyone in your camp, anyone on your team say, you know what, you don't want to do a gay love story? Because, you know, this was a few years ago.
I love the idea. I love the idea that I might have had a team or a camp back in 1984. I was a struggling actor doing mainly... making a living from writing radio commercials for Red Stripe Lager and Mighty White Sliced Bread. And then this, yeah, weirdly, I'd sort of given up on acting. This audition came along. They said, Merchant Ivory want to see you for this film, Maurice. And I thought, I'm not really interested in acting anymore. And I didn't really want to go. And then my brother, who was a banker, and I was living with him in his house, and he happened to be home that day sick, and he said, no, don't be stupid, you need some money, go. So I guess he was my team, and he said go. No one ever said, certainly no one ever said, be careful, it's a gay role. That never happened, and it was never really never featured. I mean, I think my parents were perhaps momentarily startled when I was the front cover of Zipper magazine when the film came out. I was a little startled myself because I didn't remember doing any shoot for it.
How did your parents come across Zipper magazine?
Well, I think it was there in the newsagent, you know. Perhaps, but who knows? Perhaps my father was looking for it. Who knows?
you have another Guy Ritchie movie coming along. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it's in his London gangster genre.
Yep.
And it's basically about marijuana and the state of the marijuana trade now, or marijuana crime turning to legitimacy. And there's a character of a really seedy private detective who would accept anyone's money, but mainly works for the lowest of the low newspapers, tabloid newspapers. And I think Guy thought it would be amusing to cast someone who's campaigned against that kind of stuff, you know, as a private detective working for a seedy newspaper. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you talk to any seedy newspaper reporters to find out what they do?
I did, because...
You did?
I did. I already kind of knew, but
right.
One of the weird developments over the last 7 years of this campaign is that a lot of the guys who used to do all the dark arts paid for by the newspapers have swapped sides and come over to us.
Mm.
And tell us all their secrets and kind of love us now and work with us. And so I had the strange experience of having lunch with a guy who'd hacked my phone again and again.
No.
And he was rather nice. Yeah, yeah.
Well, he knew everything about you. that's awful.
He certainly did in 2004. I mean, Christ, I hate to think what he must have heard.
Wow.
But he was useful.
Yeah. That is just so bizarre. How do you sit across from someone like that? Do you have forgiveness?
Well, it's not the first time it's happened. Like I say, a number of these guys have come across, and we have a party every year around my birthday, the campaign does. And every year, more and more people who've hacked my phone or stolen my medical records or, in one case, broken into my apartment are invited. Yeah. And I end up drinking with them. You know.
That's a very English party.
But you have to remember a very English party. But you have to remember these guys were the foot soldiers.
Right.
They were not the big wigs, the paymasters. They're still there. They're still in power in Britain.
Right. So I wanted to ask you, when was the last time you cried at the movies? Are you a crier?
Yes, pathetically so. The older I get, the more I cry. If anyone expresses love, particularly for children or animals or each other, particularly across a stretch of time, or if they hold hands to comfort each other, I'm a mess.
So when was the last time you were a mess?
I really don't know. I was having this conversation with someone today, and it's because I find films so moving or drama so moving now, I kind of avoid it. I have to watch comforting things like Formula One motor racing or ladies international tennis. Everything else is too upsetting.
Are you a big blockbuster guy? Do you do the Marvel movies and all the superhero movies?
I don't. I've tried. I must try harder.
What happened when you tried?
I didn't understand where I was or what was happening.
But
I think I'd need to start at the very beginning.
But I'm sure they've come to you and asked you to pop up in one of these movies.
It has come up. Yeah. I must admit that.
Okay.
And I would have done it, but there was a scheduling and family issue. But otherwise, I was absolutely up for it. That's when I started to watch them.
Which one was it?
I can't say because it's being made now. And I don't want to say because I don't want the person who's playing that role to think they weren't the first choice.
Why did you want to do it?
It was a juicy role. It was a juicy role, a good baddie. I love a good baddie.
And do you remember the movie that really made you fall in love with acting? That really, when you looked at the screen, you said, I want to do that?
Didn't work like that for me. But I certainly can remember the first sort of times I thought, Christ, he's good. And it was mainly Tony Hopkins.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with him. Him in Remains of the Day, a film I had a minor part in.
Mm.
Him in The Mutiny on the Bounty. Him in Howard's End. Him in all sorts of things. Marvelous. Him, Gene Hackman. You know, the usual suspects.
Right.
De Niro in almost anything. Taxi Driver, you know, Goodfellas. Marvelous.
Is there a movie that you will watch over and over again and you'll never get bored watching it?
There's not many of those, but Goodfellas is certainly one of them.
Yeah.
And at the other end of the scale, The Sound of Music. I'm ashamed to say I have a soft spot for The Sound of Music. In fact, my wife, who's Swedish and from the north of Sweden, where men are men, and they never really speak. They just chop wood and drink coffee. was horrified to find me the other day watching The Sound of Music, and not just watching it, but singing along with the Mother Superior when she sings Climb Every Mountain. And wait, crying, because I found it so moving.
I was just going to say, I have a feeling you were crying.
Oh, I was crying. It's incredible. You know, climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow every rainbow till you find your dream. It's heartbreaking.
So have you ever sung with Julie Andrews in person?
She was my mother in a movie of the week I did.
Wow.
In about 1990. Yeah. I was sitting there, an unemployed actor in London, and I got a call to come and be in a movie of the week in L.A. about AIDS. And Zeljko Ivanic was my lover. Julie Andrews was my mother. And and I do an American accent.
Mm.
And it's they were marvelous people. I think I let them all down, but they were a very good team.
But did you sing with Julie?
But it was surreal acting with it was surreal, yeah. I mean, yeah. There is, you know, there was Maria von Trapp and Mary Poppins coming out of her trailer towards me.
Do you ever?
Strange. To me, she's the biggest star in the world, and always will be. You know?
Do you ever have those moments still, like surreal, starstruck? Do they ever pop up?
Yes, all the time. Yeah, sure. I shook Roger Federer's hand the other day and nearly fainted.
Why?
I don't know. I just think he's so impressive.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Grant, which I've been wanting to say this entire interview because I'm a journalist and I wanted to say, Mr. Grant, thank you for this.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's very nice to meet you on the phone.
Well, I'm glad you made this happen. I loved talking to you, and hopefully I will see you at the Emmys.
Yeah, okay. Terrific.
Thanks, sir. Mark. Bye-bye. That was Hugh Grant, and I'm Mark Malkin. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. Remember, a new episode drops every Thursday. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter and Instagram @MarkMalkin. Until next time.